there were some opportunities that I thought were perfect, right? But we all have a learning curve. We all make mistakes. But it really has taught me a lot, too, about not necessarily like siloing myself, but learning how to stay in my swim lane without swinging out too far.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Exit Is Now podcast with me, your host, Scott Snyder. Hang out with Julie Keyes, who came in from Minneapolis, Minnesota. I think you're outside of Minneapolis now in your lake house, so we'll talk about that. Mm-hmm. Before we dive in and I more formally talk about Julie and introduce her to all of you and listeners on the show here, big deal. This is about our 20th episode, but about 20 or so episodes in, I'd like to thank all of you, our listeners. I'd like to thank my team here and then all of our SEPA community, EPI community followers as well. Through the Stevie Awards, we won bronze for the most innovative business podcast. So if you're watching in and tuning in via our video stream, you could see this nice little bronze medal that we achieved. But pretty cool. I mean, we're not even a full year into this thing. And I could tell you that... I just talked to some really cool guests. The show really comes together by everybody working behind the scenes that probably don't get enough credit. So thank you to my team and everybody that has supported the show. It's been one hell of a run. So thank you for that. So I want to get into my guest here. So when I think about Julie Keyes, I think a friend. I think she's been a really good mentor to me since I met her in 2015 when she became a SEPA. But if you're a certified exit planning advisor or one of the many people that hang out in the EPI community that might not be certified, you probably know Julie. Julie became a SEPA in 2015. She's a two-time Excellence in Exit Planning Award winner. She's a speaker, an author. We have her book, Poised for Exit, right here that we'll certainly get into and talk about. She is a fellow podcaster, so I want to ask you about that because this is not actually as easy as I thought it was going to be.
Right.
And then she's the founder of the Twin Cities Metro Area Chapter, one of our longest running chapters, super impactful stuff. I want to talk about the State of Owner Readiness Survey that we completed and launched in the state of Minnesota, and is a faculty member and instructor. So I know I've told you this before, but without doubt, you've made a personal impact on me on EPI. But I think your impact can honestly be felt throughout the EPI community. So thank you and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
So one of the things that I always find fascinating about bringing in what I would refer to as like an entrepreneurial advisor is that certainly your advisor and your SEPA role, your value advisor role, but you're a 35-year maybe plus entrepreneur. So as a fellow entrepreneur, I want to start there and talk about Julie as the business owner, not necessarily Julie as an advisor to business owners. So I was telling you before we came on the show, I want to kind of time travel all the way back, I think, to like 1989, 1990, where you were in a company called Keyes Legal and Title Services. That was 20 years, or that was, what was that? That was 30 plus years ago.
Yeah.
But you made nearly a 20-year run in that business, which is like it's pretty crazy. And in EPI... is coming up on their 20th anniversary in 2025. So Peter Chrisman and Rich Jackham founded EPI in 2005, SEPA designation created in 2007. But time flies. So talk to me about, was that your first company or what was it like back then in 1989 when you were working as an entrepreneur?
Yeah, it kind of evolved just like most businesses do. It went from one company to four companies.
Yeah.
And I probably wouldn't have ended if our marriage didn't end.
Oh, okay. So yeah, right. So you were affected by one of these 5 Ds.
We were diving into the 5 Ds. Yeah. Yeah, without going into too much detail that, right?
Yeah.
But I think some of the biggest lessons that I learned, don't hire family and friends.
Oh.
Yeah, that was a tough lesson a couple times, actually.
Yep.
Learn how to say no.
Okay.
Okay. Mm. I recognize opportunity. I'm pretty good at that. I'm also pretty good at creating opportunity, right? Sure. You don't sit home and wait for the phone to ring, right? And you go out there and figure it out. But not every opportunity that comes along is one that you should take advantage of.
Totally.
Even if it's a good opportunity.
That's true.
So that, I think, when I was thinking about this, I was like, all right, there were some opportunities that I thought were perfect, right? But we all have a learning curve. We all make mistakes, but it really has taught me a lot too about not necessarily like siloing myself, but learning how to stay in my swim lane without swinging out too far.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Totally. We talk a lot about that in the EPI community when you're a SEPA, is that you're kind of come from all different walks of professional advisory life when you become a certified exit planning advisor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the excitement after you become a SEPA says, hey, I'm an expert financial advisor, but this whole business advisory stuff seems pretty interesting. Maybe I can sway over there. Or, you know, maybe I'm a, you know, whatever it might be. But we always talk about these lanes and how you kind of got to pick a lane. But I would say, not only is that, I think, very relevant for a lot of SEPAs that are likely listening, but it would be a business lesson I would share as well. Like when you're when you're first starting a business, or when you're certainly younger and more ambitious, saying no is tough, especially when you're, I had Chris on the show, my dad on the show a couple episodes ago, talking about our journey together.
Yeah.
And when you're much smaller, you're in this like revenue generation phase, cash generation. So it's like, yes, yes, yes. And anything to kind of keep the thing afloat.
Right.
But it is. That's a really good lesson. Just pick a lane, stay in it, and maybe pick a couple of side lanes, but know that you're an expert in one thing.
Well, and I think that when you're an opportunist by nature and industrious by nature, you might think in your head, because you're optimistic, because you believe, because you know that, you know, you've been able to, you know, accomplish all these other things in the past, doesn't mean that you necessarily can if you have a team that you need to help you, right?
Yeah.
So you have to do some really good assessing of, you know, what kind of resources do we need? What kind of capacity do we have? What kind of capabilities do we have, right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
So those were all tough lessons that I had to learn. And I think another lesson was just working with the right advisors. I mean, I'm not kidding you.
Interesting that you say that now as an advisor.
Yeah, yeah.
So you rewind back to 89 through that 20-year run. Working with the right advisors, I think, is key.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I had to report our accounting firm to the board.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah.
That bad, huh?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Man, tough.
Anyway.
So you do that, and then you move into a coaching franchise. And I always think franchising is a unique model for many business owners. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, my dad always used to talk about when I was running my landscaping company, he realized, obviously, I was entrepreneurial. And he said, look, maybe you should sell the landscaping company, but given your entrepreneurial spirit, get into and buy a franchise. Maybe that's a business we can do together.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'll ask Dad this on the next show. I think one of his recommendations was a little bit out of fear as well, saying, hey, my son's a pretty young guy here. I was probably like 21, 22, 23 years old. Some structure would be nice. And so I've never owned a franchise. I mean, so I don't know from direct experience. But I think it's a kind of an interesting model, because you do get some additional supports and a brand and all that stuff versus just a purebred startup. So talk about that experience in a franchise, because somebody that is kind of opportunistic, ambitious, creative, visionary, I can also see how it's kind of like holding you back, because you got to operate in this framework, right?
You do.
Yeah.
And then if the framework doesn't really serve you, you're spending a lot of money and not getting a lot of return. And that was really where I found myself working in the franchise. And, you know, to your point about like having things set up and not having to do that as a startup, there were still plenty of things to do as a startup.
I
mean, I'm at an age where I really don't have a lot of time to lose, you know? And, you know, I was starting over. And before I actually became a consultant, I had to take a job. Mm-hmm. I call it a J-O-B.
Yeah.
because I needed to go buy a house. I was still raising kids.
Right.
And I needed to qualify for a loan. And so, when you're self-employed, you have to have at least a two-year history. So I thought, well, screw it. I'll just go get a job and, you know, buy the house. So that's what I did. I got a job, bought a house, quit my job the month after I moved in, and then launched the coaching business a month later.
Okay.
Flew out to the East Coast, went through the training, you know, got the branding stuff done. But as far as the franchise goes, I think they're not all the same.
Yeah.
You know, they have processes and systems, and they have technology, and they have advertising. But if the advertising they're doing is national, and then, you know, this was 12 years ago, you're really not going to benefit from that, right? if they're not as much as in a
digital. Well, you're not in a digital era as much as, I mean, you were, but not as much as you are today. So to your point, national advertising, like how is that really bringing it to the local community where I'm at?
Yeah.
Because you were working with local folks, right?
Yeah, I was. Yeah. But there was a lot of promises made that because of the franchise, I was going to be able to acquire clients without a whole lot of effort because they had this great lead generation program going, which you know, ended up being kind of an empty promise. So so I did, you know, acquire my own business. And then eventually I just like, and I won awards with them too.
Yeah.
You know, and which was nice, you know, to have that.
Certainly.
But I just decided it was time to move on.
Yeah. So you moved on to what you're doing today, and you've been in that business for like 12 years, I think, give or take. Mm-hmm. And during that time, you also, you started that business, then became a certified exit planning advisor and all that stuff. So what's life like today? You're primarily working with business owners, right? Well, I guess at breakfast today, too, you're talking to me about some of the stuff you're developing to help fellow advisors launch their firms. So kind of talk about what's going on today.
Yeah. Well, the program that I'm launching is basically a conglomeration of content that I've delivered in one way or another for pretty much years. Since the beginning, right? Via webinar, via presentation, via workshop, and then the need for these advisory firms to get somebody to help them like shorten the learning curve, figure out what services they're going to deliver, how they're going to charge for it, you know, how to integrate it into their current practice. I just thought, well, I'm already doing all that. And so it came to me two or three times from different firms. We could really use your help. So I created this program out of a request, basically.
Yeah.
And so that's what it is. It's a 6-session program teaching you all of those things, and then followed by a 6-month cohort where we actually talk about your practice. Like, what are you really doing? Where can we really help you? What kind of client issues you got? Let's talk about solutions.
So that's kind of an interesting swing on things. But you're also working with small, lower middle market business owners, right?
Yes. Yeah. I'll always work with owners. Yeah. I like.
Yeah. What attracts you to them? Like what?
Yeah. Well, I am one. You know?
Right. Well, you're a lifelong entrepreneur.
And I was, you know, before I became an advisor, and then I was raised as an entrepreneur. You know, that's what we talked about around the dinner table every night was business.
Were your parents entrepreneurs?
Yeah, my mom, my dad, my grandparents on both sides.
What kind of stuff were they doing?
There was always a company to talk about.
Yeah, what kind? How many brothers and sisters do you have?
I just have two younger sisters.
Two younger sisters.
Yeah.
But what kind of companies did your parents or grandparents own?
My mom was an independent rep for a wholesale art company out of Chicago.
Hmm.
She was the number one rep in the country, and she had like 15 or so people that she managed.
Wow.
Yeah, in addition to her own book.
Okay.
So she was doing really well. And then her family owned banks. And so she was in the bank for a while.
Okay.
And so, you know, knowing the banking business, knowing what it's like, you know, it's not all rosy.
Yeah.
So lots of stories around that. And then on my dad's side of the family, they were all farmers. And so when people say that farmers are not self-employed, then, I mean, that's the riskiest probably business there is, right? So that was their business. But my dad was actually insurance, financial services, securities. Yeah.
So in the same realm that you're kind of in now, these professional advisory services. Yeah.
Yeah. And he tried so hard to get me to take his business over.
Really?
He did.
So why not?
I just didn't see that it was for me.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Yeah, fair.
Maybe because of all the stories I heard around the dinner table growing up.
Yeah, growing up,
like,
you're like,
I don't want to do that.
Well, that sounds like that's not a business that I want to go into. But I can appreciate that. We always say that E.J. Snyder, so my great-grandfather, the story behind E.J. is he was a farmer, so down in central Ohio, about 2.5 hours south of us here in Cleveland. And I agree, like they're self-employed, they are entrepreneurs, like, and it's some of the, I think some of the roughest, the farmers, certainly back then, right? So that was like Great Depression era, right?
Yeah.
So the story goes, though, how really the Snyder family jumped into entrepreneurship was that EJ didn't believe in banks. So he just he was like the typical guy that you see in the storybooks where he's shoving money in mattresses and in walls.
Sure.
And it ended up working out great for him. So when the depression hit, he came up to Cleveland and just started buying property in like the Cleveland metropolis area, right? The big city at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Just started buying land for pennies on the dollar.
Yeah.
So he has all this land and he passes away. So his two boys inherit all the land. And voila, Snyder Family Real Estate is born.
Isn't that amazing?
Right. So now they're kind of thrust into entrepreneurship with all this land.
Yeah.
Both creative guys, my grandpa Richard and his brother, Bill, But Bill and Richard then didn't get along all that well, so they split the company and went two ways. I think back then, Bill started concentrating on commercial real estate development and ownership. And then I think my grandpa went into homes, like residential development. Now that business is with my Uncle Mark. So my dad's, one of my dad has seven siblings. So one of my dad's older brothers. But in my transition out of landscape, I hung out with Uncle Mark a little bit to learn the ropes of there, because Snyder Real Estate has been around since EJ. But yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
It's kind of a cool, it's like your story. It's always been around me.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a natural fit entrepreneurship for our family, just like you.
Yeah. When my grandfather bought the first bank, he was hired actually to turn it around because it had been embezzled by the president.
Oh, great.
So, yeah. Yeah. So it was failing. Yeah. And he turned around, and as he was doing the work, the turnaround work, he just thought, this is probably going to be a good investment. I should probably take advantage of this, right?
Yeah.
So instead of going to law school, which is what he was planning to do, after college, he decided to invest in this bank and then more.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. See, that's a super cool story. But yeah, I could always imagine we didn't have, like, my dad wasn't really an entrepreneur until I was older, but we certainly had the dinner to Campbell conversations. But I couldn't imagine having a mom and a dad and a grandfather who were all entrepreneurs sitting around even like the Christmas or Thanksgiving table, what some of those business ownership stories that you were hearing were like. I mean, that's pretty cool experience.
It is. And at the same time, it's like there was this unwritten rule that we didn't talk so much about business when we were together as a family, like for events.
Okay.
Dinner table, we did maybe a little bit more than we should have. But yet with the large scale events, they kind of left that, which is good, right?
Yeah, that's great.
Really, when you talk about family business governance, that's one of the top things, right?
Yeah, it's like, yeah,
leave don't business at work.
Leave the business at work, especially around the holidays.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, me and my dad, I think, do a pretty good job at that, although I always laugh. I think I was telling this story maybe a couple of podcasts ago. We do all of our partners' meetings, like our one-on-one. So me and dad meet once a month, usually in the afternoon, because we tie this into a dinner. So it allows me to get some time with mom and dad, right? So I go over and do a formal business meeting. We do it at stand-up meeting for 2-3 hours at the kitchen counter, the island there. And mom's lingering around, right? So if mom comes in, they have this big great room, right? That's kitchen and family room. You either know where it's getting too heated, which it doesn't really happen a lot, or more so than not, you know that we're going over time and it's time to go to dinner. So mom will come downstairs, sit in the family room, and just turn on the TV really loud. So, and me and dad look like, dude, we're trying to finish up a meeting here, mom, you know? And mom's like, well, it's 6 o'clock. We have those reservations at 6:15 and we should get going over there, boys. So that's our governance, right? You got mom coming to kind of clean it up. So going back to your kind of entrepreneurial story. So this year at the Exit Planning Summit, we held the first ever Women in Exit Planning Symposium. And interesting enough, when I was looking at that, one of your first businesses, the Keys Legal and Title Services, back in 1989, 1990, only 28% of American businesses were owned by women. And if you look at the stats today, it's nearly 50%. It's 42%, and some surveys even said 49% of the American businesses in 2023 were owned by women. And it just got me thinking that, you've been doing this a long time, 30, 35 years, as an entrepreneur, as a business advisor. And it's just, I would love your perspective on what it's like to be a woman entrepreneur for 35 years. I mean, it has to be a lot different than it is today than it was 30 years ago when you're first starting out. What's that like?
Yeah, some things are the same and some things are better.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Okay, so talk to it.
Yeah. Initially, when we first launched the businesses, which was really my idea, my husband at the time just wanted to stay, practicing law. He really didn't want to start a company, but I'm like, well, you already really have, because he had a couple of really large clients. Yeah. That warranted us starting our own agency.
Okay.
Right? So practicing law, having a title agency, and then working more commercial than residential, but we did both in 3 counties.
Yeah.
So we had 3 different locations and we evolved into all of that. But what comes to mind, well, 2 things. One was, because I was more the face of the business, I'm in a man's world still. I mean, it's getting better, but still, right? When you talk about professional services,
sure.
At the time it was the only women that were in the business were the ones who were actually the settlement people.
Okay.
The runners of the business, the marketing people, the presidents, they were all men. Hmm. And so gaining credibility in an industry that was dominated by men was really difficult. Hmm. And, you know, plenty of skirt chasers out there, yeah. Right? And yeah, so I didn't deal with that very well, but.
I don't strike me as somebody that would.
No, no, yeah, but really I, you know, style. The thing is that you just got to have staying power. And
yeah,
just
like resilience
really believe
too,
in,
grit.
Yeah, exactly. And then another situation, like just going to the bank, opening another office, right? Mm-hmm. So the lender knows me, I know the lender. We're opening another location. We want to open up some more accounts because each company that we started obviously had to have, you know, their own accounts.
Sure.
And getting grief that because Bill wasn't there, that they really couldn't do anything until he was present. I'm like, I run the companies.
Yeah.
I mean, so what's the problem?
Yeah.
And like I told you last night, it reminded me of the Grinch, you know, where
Cindy
Lou Who comes toddling out and the Grinch is going to steal her Christmas tree.
Right.
And he just pats her on the head and sends her off with a little cup of water, right?
That's how it felt for you.
Yeah. Like I was just being dismissed, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. It's got to be frustrating, right?
That was a little bit beyond frustrating, but, but what ended up happening though with that banking relationship is I just moved on. Like I stayed with them for that particular branch for that particular location. But then when I moved into other locations and geographic areas, I just was like, it doesn't make any sense to me to have one banking relationship. And so I advise my clients that all the time.
Yeah.
You really need to have
multiple.
More than one banking relationship, no matter. Yeah.
So, you know, like given the women in exit planning symposium this past spring at the summit, you know, what are some of the topics that are hitting home for you now? Because I think a lot of like for EPI, for example, about give or take half of our company is female. And I would, and frankly, younger females. So I think that if I were one of them, I think that I'd look to you as a mentor, somebody that's done it 30, 35 years, to your point early on, more in a man's world. Maybe a little bit more even these days, but what's it like today for you? Because you mentioned it could be better, some of the same.
It could be better. I think maybe not so much for me, but for women who are in like scalable businesses such as like manufacturing or, you know, construction services or, you know, businesses like that. I have plenty of people that are in my network that are, would be constituted as being in a like a male dominated business when they're female owners. Access to capital is an issue. Mm. Access to capital has been an issue for a while.
Okay.
And I think that part of the reason why there's an issue with access to capital is because they're not networked properly.
Mm, like, we were talking about this last night a little bit on the way home.
Right. I mean, your network is your net worth. That's been my mantra forever. Your network should provide at least 70% of your business. That's my belief. That's how it works for me. That's how it should work, especially in professional services. But really, your network is everything. And if you're not networked with the right people, if you're just, you know, hanging out with a bunch of small business women entrepreneurs who are trying to figure out what's next, then no one has any answers.
That's fair.
They might enjoy each other's company,
right?
But hang out with people that have the answers.
So why don't you think they're well networked though? Because they tend to lean into these like women groups, or what's the answer?
It's
like, what's
never
the,
been my gig.
It's not your gig.
Not at all. But it is for many.
For many. So your advice then to younger women would be to also get out there a little bit,
take some chances,
be a little bit vulnerable. I guess it would be
exactly. And you don't have to save the world.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
Right. Especially for those that are established who have, you know, strong teams of employees. I think that, you know, one of the reasons why I wrote that book and kind of directed it towards women is number one, I had my own experience, right?
Sure.
Yeah. I couldn't find any book on exit planning that was focused on women entrepreneurs.
Yeah, when you're right. So, yeah, if you're watching in, we have Julie's book here, although this is the original first edition, but if you go on Amazon, you can see it's called Poise for Exit, also the name of her podcast. But yeah, it's a woman entrepreneur's guide to business transition.
Yeah.
So do you think women also have differences in terms of value and what multiples they get upon transition?
No, I don't think so. But I think they maybe hang on a little bit too long because they don't really know who they are outside of the ownership of their company. I lived that myself. I mean, men live that, right? We all have that identity crisis kind of in a way, right? Yeah. I remember getting a phone call. I was at my cabin at the time, and I got a phone call from my broker telling me that there was an offer on the table for our business that we didn't want to refuse. Like, there were other ones, but he goes, This is the really good, Julie. You're gonna be excited about this.
Yeah.
So then, as we're talking, I could like feel like the blood rushing up into my throat, my head. I could tell my head was probably like beet red, right?
Yeah.
And it was because I was like, "What am I gonna do now?"
Yeah. What's next?
I didn't know.
Yeah. So you're holding on,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, I was only like 42.
Yeah, but totally.
Yeah, I was like, well, I'm not going to retire. I mean, I got to do something, right? I'm not that kind of person.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So when owners have those feelings and have those issues, I can relate to that. And for women, we definitely are like moms a lot of times to our employees. I'm not kidding. I don't, you know, they try not to be, and we all want to be good leaders, but it's just it's a nurturing characteristic that most women have.
Yeah.
And to deny that that's there is kind of living a lie. It's just there, right?
Yeah.
And so letting go of them, I found that to be very challenging for a lot of women clients that I write about in the book.
Yeah. So that's actually a really good point. I didn't think about that kind of nurturing of your employees, and now you're going to leave. What's going to happen to them?
Right.
Do you, I don't know if you know this or not, it would be interesting to study women in transition and find out if they lean into employee ownership a little bit more than maybe men do.
You know, that would be a good statistic to learn.
Right?
Yeah, because honestly, women entrepreneurs, that whole world is so underserved.
Yeah.
So underserved.
Well, it's one of the reasons that our team and even our SEPAs, and SEPAs like you said, Scott, I think this would be, since your conference is like a larger 5, 6, 7, approaching 800 person event.
Right.
And honestly, I think we have pretty good numbers in terms of the male to female ratio.
You do, yeah.
They said, why don't we bring the women together and talk about issues in this space, or not even maybe issues, but how to accelerate the growth of our practices as women. And I think we talked about this in the car too. The one disappointment I have is there wasn't a lot of guys there. There was me, my dad popped in, and two other gentlemen that were SEPAs that hung out. And I said, well, I don't know why you wouldn't come to an event like this. I mean, for me, half my team is a woman. So I probably stand to learn something. Maybe it's, I will say in all honesty, this probably just sounds like a typical dude right now, but it has to be how like you felt in your career, sitting in this group of 40 women and like 2 or 3 guys. I was like, ooh, this is kind of.
Yeah.
Uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I was typically, as the white guy in the room, you don't feel that at all, right? Because it's pretty normal for you to be there.
Yeah.
But yeah, so anyways,
well,
it is.
Like the old adage, just get comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Exactly right.
And that there's no growth without it.
Right.
But yeah, I don't think that it should have been just exclusively women, and it sounded like it wasn't, because the only way that we're ever going to unite and work together is for us to understand each other.
Understand each other.
Right. 100%. And like, say, for instance, you're an advisor and you're thinking about specializing, specializing in working with women entrepreneurs. Like I said before, underserved, totally underserved. And so many companies out there, like really super successful companies, women who really know what they're doing, making tracks. And they tend to stick together.
Yeah.
Right. Entrepreneurs stick together anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So last question on the kind of that front too. One of the things I think is I would assume is difficult during this time too. You're also raising a family, so talk about that nurture. So how was it being an entrepreneur? As an entrepreneur myself, I understand the hours that we're putting in and the passion and the exhaust. It's really not about the time. It's about to me, it's always about the mental capacity. You're just exhausted, whether it's a 5-hour day or a 15 hour day.
Yeah.
What was that like doing that and being a mom?
It was very long days. I mean, you know, 16 hours a day.
Yeah.
That's no exaggeration either. Yeah. You know, I'd be doing laundry till 11 or 12 o'clock every night. That's the only time I can get it done.
The only thing, because
you're running to sports, you're doing homework, you're making dinner, you're, you know, doing all that at the nighttime and running people around. And So
I think it's something that I think many younger women today kind of struggle with, right? It's like their want to be career oriented and excel in their profession. But maybe going back to that nurture, like, hey, I also want to be a mom, though. I just think it's kind of I don't know if I'm as, if that's as top of mind to me as it might be for a woman. Maybe I don't know.
But, yeah, I think it's different for everybody. Yeah. And I think that you just have to find your way.
Yeah.
And again, like I said before, you have to learn how to say no. And that's there were, advice, you know, there were times that that I should have said no and didn't. So if I said that I don't have any regrets about those years, I'd be lying. I mean, I think that we all do, right?
Sure, of course.
But I also know that I raised some really amazing kids. They're all successful. We're very close. We do a lot together.
It's very cool.
Yeah.
It's very cool. That's, yeah. I think it's what I was saying. It's one of the coolest things to watch your big family parties at the lake house and and how, how together. Reminds me a lot of, honestly, like me, Ashley, mom and dad, my sister Ashley, we're a pretty tight
for sure
group as well.
Well, when you like to do a lot of the same things.
Well, there's that too.
Yeah.
Makes it a little bit
easier. Everybody's pretty competitive.
Yep.
You know, nobody's a slouch.
Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, we dig in, like play hard, man.
We had my mom and dad have a lake house and they have this big annual summer party where we shove 17 people into the house and we're all on air mattresses or the ground.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, this year was the first ever Snyder family lake house games. But you have like multiple, you have the Kozlowskis, the Shops, the Snyders, and the Doyers, all a part of the Snyder unit, right?
Nice.
And my sister and brother-in-law took it by far. So we'll have to go back. We made a trophy and everything.
Sweet.
Talk about competitive. I was like, man, I think my family came in last. So we weren't all that great this year. But I want to get into some of the Certified Exit Planning Advisor stuff and talk about how you've built that practice and a little bit more about how you're working with owners now. We're going to do that, though, right after the break. So stick with us, and we'll be right back.
The Exit Planning Institute is the authority in exit planning. With its award-winning process, the value acceleration methodology provides deep insights into how to help business owners create more significant companies while blending and aligning their business, personal, and financial goals. EPI brings together the world's most elite exit planning advisors to form the EPI community. The EPI community represents over 15,000 professional advisors worldwide, including its 5,000 certified exit planning advisors. These advisors include financial advisors, growth consultants, CPAs, attorneys, M&A advisors, amongst others, who come together to expand their knowledge, create and innovate, network and relationship build, grow their practices, and better attract and engage business owner clients. Join EPI today and gain access to the community, content, courses, credential, and conference that you as the professional advisor need in order to harness the opportunity with small to lower middle market business owners who strive to grow a company of significance, thus having a highly valuable and transferable company. Follow the Exit Planning Institute on LinkedIn and visit earnsepa.com to learn more about the community leading the exit planning profession.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Exit Is Now podcast. So I want to roll into now with you, Julie, your role as a certified exit planning advisor, kind of how you built that practice, and then talk a little bit about the work that you've done over the past 7 or 8 years, specifically within the state of Minnesota, because we just had our survey come out there. So let's rewind again and start at the beginning. So 3 years after starting your practice, you then decided to become a SEPA in 2015. So during the break, we were reflecting on that would have been basically 2 years after the value acceleration methodology debuted inside of the EPI and inside of the SEPA program. It would have been before my dad's book, right? So Walking to Destiny came out in 2016. So you would have still been reading and preparing the $10 trillion opportunity book that many of us probably don't even necessarily know about now because we've been obviously pivoted into the Walking to Destiny stuff. And you would have probably had a smaller class, like a class of 15 or 25 at most people. And we would have been, dad and I would have been 3 years into owning the business. So certainly an early pioneer. So I always find this fascinating. We were talking earlier in the first segment too, about like digital marketing and finding people. And I can't believe like, what attracted you to the program? Like, do you remember finding, how did you find EPI?
Yeah, good question. I started acquiring clients that were of the age where they really needed help with transition planning. Mm. And the franchise that I was with before had rights to use the sellability score, which, which is now called the Value Builder.
Right.
The John Warlow tool.
Yeah, sure.
So what came with the sellability score assessment was some basic content for using for presentations.
Okay.
And I started doing these presentations for business owners to talk about how to get ready. And as I started doing that and as I started talking to different owners and different advisors, I was just thinking, I need to know so much more about this than I know.
Sure.
Just because I had my own experience doesn't make me an expert, that's for sure, right?
Yeah.
And the more you get into it, the more you realize that you don't know. I think that's kind of life. The older you get, the more you realize you don't know.
You don't know.
Yeah. It's the way it goes. Anyway, I heard about EPI from Sean Sima.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah, sure.
So
he was a SEPA.
He was already a SEPA. He had just been through the program, him and Ben.
Yeah.
And they were at the workshop that I was teaching on the sellability score. And he said, he goes, if you're going to do this, you know, into the future, he goes, you should really think about getting your SEPA. I'm like, I'm down.
So, yeah, you come to, you were saying November's class in Chicago.
Yeah, Diane and I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then after that, I met with them and I said, all right, we got to take this seriously. We got to launch a chapter.
Yeah, because you would have had, in this state of owner readiness research, right, you would have had at the time then, well, I guess even you would have had less probably, but in 2017, when you produced or the first state of owner readiness survey there, you only had 9 SEPAs. So, I mean, if it was like you, Diane, Ben, and Sean, you had at 4. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you say, now what are we going to do? Because you really leaned hard into EPI post-SEPA program for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just knew that we had to start a chapter. That was the best way for us to be able to launch it in our market and, you know, make a name for ourselves as exit planners and then learn from other experts too, right? Because you learn when you when you belong to a chapter and you go to chapter meetings, you learn about different disciplines and, you know, deals. And I mean, being the networker that I am, you know, very purposeful networking, by the way, not spraying. Very intentional and very, very purposeful. But that has been an extremely valuable strategy for me in education of my own, you know, my own learning.
Yeah, I mean,
aside from reading books, but I mean, just hearing cases and talking to people and what they're going through and doing that on a regular basis. So I knew the chapter would be the same thing.
I always find it a unique way to network when you can get in and actually, to your point, work a case. Because it reminds me of 2011 when Dad and I started the first chapter of the Exit Planning Institute. Though when we helped you start your chapters, it was kind of still kind of a little willy-nilly, like a little bit Wild West style of launching these things. And I always appreciate you taking that ride with us a little bit.
Yeah.
But my dad's very similar to your point. He said, look, I want to be able to network with a bunch of people. And I want to be able to learn about all kinds of different, at least their perspective from different professional disciplines.
Right.
So let's start a chapter. And I always think it's kind of a cool way to network because me and you could go out for a cocktail and do the traditional handshake and BS about a bunch of stuff and just get to know each other. But it's like a deeper level when me and you can sit here and say, well, you're the growth consultant. I'm the attorney. How would we look at this same business owner? Let's learn from each other.
Right.
And I think the chapters did that then. And then talk about more laser focus and intentional. It's a part of the actual curriculum now. So we give them 3 case studies that they can incorporate into their regular 10 or 12 meetings a year.
Fabulous.
Where you learn from each other. But yeah, I mean, you would have started that like right away. You would have November and then like a year later in 2016, the Twin Cities Metro Area chapter.
Yeah, we launched in May of that year.
In May of that year. So you would have just, boom, like a handful of months later, you're making it happen.
Pedal to the metal, man.
So from there, you start doing the chapter, and then in 2017, you launched the State of Owner Readiness Research, which also had to be one of the first, if not the first, regional research that we had done, because we had like the national in 2013. And I think you had said to us, again, taking this ride, entrepreneurial ride with us, hey, Chris and Scott, can we take that survey here locally? And we're like, I guess not. Why not? And then you had your first ever business owners forum that same year, like shortly thereafter to promote the results. So talk about that. Like now you've gone from within a year educating and networking and bringing advisors together. Now you want to start to get to the business owner community too. And I remember it was a pretty robust event. back then. I can really appreciate it now, putting on larger events. You had multiple breakout rooms, the big, that was at what, the University of Minnesota or something like that?
Yeah, McNamara.
Yeah, it was a beautiful center. But talk about that. Okay, now I want to go into educating business owners and why you felt that was important.
I think just the, you know, the fact that exit planning requires collaboration, right? It requires professional collaboration, and that, you know, the education of the business owner is the primary focus, right? Because educated owners make better decisions. And so, but if the advisors aren't educated, if the advisors aren't really aware of how things are supposed to go, then the ripple effect of that is not going to be positive. So I think the one of the reasons why our survey results are favorable,
more
so than in 2017, is 100%. Because we had, you know, such a focus on getting the word out, creating awareness. You know, my show, even though it's a national show, it's local too, and there's a lot of advisors that listen to it, and then they share right the episodes with their clients, which I invite them to do after every show. And then when the advisor community is getting it, and there's more SEPAs now, then that obviously is going to trickle down into helping the owners make better decisions. So, I mean, I'm happy that the outcome has is what it is, you know, with the results of that survey as compared to 5 years ago, 6 years ago.
Yeah, you just have me thinking about something when you talk about collaboration too. You've always been the collaborator for our community too. And what I thought, one of the things that you did beautifully in with the Twin City Metro Area's chapter is bringing in other organizations. It was one thing when I was putting together and analyzing these survey results from this year's State of Owner Readiness Survey in Minnesota. I just said these, and we'll talk about the results here shortly, but we were looking at this thing saying, man, like these results are really different than 2017. So I just happened to Google exit planning in Minnesota, and literally dozens, maybe even 100 events came up. And it was all the people that you started to collaborate way back when, like ACG. And so I think that has been something that you have done really nicely, is not only is it about bringing together a different set of advisors, but you were also able to bring together different organizations where it was EPI among six or seven collaborators. Well, how did you do, like, how did you do that? I know that's on a lot of chapter presidents' minds. How do I get to the ACG, the AMNAA, the CPA Society, the Financial Planning Association, the SBDCs? How did you bring everybody together?
Got to know the leaders of those organizations first and talk to them about what their goals were, what their plans were for, you know, future meetings. Tried to be a courteous leader and, you know, just say, okay, well, we don't really want to overlap a lot of our meetings on when your meetings are going to be, which is how we decided when we were going to have our chapter meetings, so that we wouldn't have to pull people from one organization to come to our meeting.
Yeah, 'cause you guys are all competing.
You're going to have some overlap, right? But if there's anything you can do to avoid the overlap, which also then, of course, opened the door to, well, what if we had some joint meetings?
Right, exactly. Okay? Yes.
And so that's that's how it started. Like, why would we not want to capitalize on our database, your database together, right? Because there's strength in numbers. And try to cross-pollinate a little bit like that, right? Because there's more business that way.
Exactly. More is more.
More is more.
I think a lot of people, maybe not as, I'll take that back, maybe not as much now as back then, like when we were starting that, when we were starting that chapter, but I don't know why, even in today's world, that there's the scarcity thing. There's millions of business owners that need help.
Yes.
And if we can successfully continue to transition these businesses, they'll continue to want our services, right?
Right.
To help them almost be their resident, I always say like their resident CVO, their chief value officer.
Yeah.
So it's just a new way of thinking. Right. So it's not like, remember back then, even the CPA firms would be like, why would I talk to my clients about exit planning? Because I'm just going to be selling off all my client base. Yeah. I'm like, well, not if you do it well, because if I do it well with your firm, the new owner or the new entity might want to retain you because you've directed that owner in such a great direction. So more is more is more is more. So if we can actually help owners transition more businesses better, then it's not scarcity at all.
It's a proactive mindset.
It is.
That's really what it is. At the end of the day, instead of being, you know, motivated by fear that you're going to lose clients, so let's not even go there and shove it under the rug and pretend it's not an issue. And oh, by the way, that business might go down and it might be your fault.
Right. Exactly. Right. Exactly. Like,
So let's take a stand.
Well, talk about proactive education, right? So you guys have always done that and done it well. So here are some stats from the State of Owner Readiness Survey in 2023. Remind yourselves that we did the same survey, same questions back in 2017. And for somebody that's dedicated, almost 13 years now of my career to this particular space and an owner, an exit owner myself, it was like I was talking to our team. Like, it was such a nice thing to see because, like, our work has paid off.
Yes.
So in 2017, we asked the business owners in Minnesota, how much attention have you given your exit strategy? One of the answers that you could answer was, well, it's my top priority, right? 6% in 2017 said it was their top priority. Mm-hmm. 2023, 28% are saying it's their top priority. So there's also like some attention, little attention, a lot of attention, but top priority, mm-hmm. 28%. We asked if the owner has done any formal education around what it takes to actually transition and build value and align these business, personal, financial goals. So have you done formal education around the topic? 30% said yes in 2017. 51% said yes in 2023. So another win. Right?
Nice.
Another, I think, huge win. We asked them, do you have a formal transition advisory team, a formal exit planning team in mm-hmm. place? 2017, 27% said, yes, I have a team. This year, 40% of them have a team, so a formal team. And then this is the big one. We asked, do you have formal written plans for your exit strategy? 2017, 6% said yes. I have a formal written strategy. 2023, 43% wow. They have a formal documented written strategy.
Wow.
So I want to say for somebody that has founded that chapter and all the leaders that are there and perhaps even listening now, thank you for busting your butt and driving home this proactive approach in education. Because not only are they saying, these owners are saying, again, they're aware of what's going on, so they're knowledgeable about exit planning.
Mm-hmm.
But they also are doing something about it. Now, obviously, we got to peel the layer of the onion back and
right.
investigate a little bit more.
Exactly.
But these are wildly different. But to your point,
they are wildly different.
You guys have been doing events there for 6-7 years. You have your annual business owners forum with unbelievably great speakers. And you guys have really dedicated yourself to a regional and statewide education and partnerships to really help business owners. So it's got to, hopefully it feels good for everybody mm-hmm. there. The question I have for you, though, with this, and we talked a little bit about this last night when we were hanging out having dinner, is it generationally driven? So you're operating certainly mm-hmm. regionally, but nationally as an advisor, boots on the ground. I'd like to think, and maybe it's my bias being an almost 40-year-old guy, that we're just a little bit more open to the exit planning conversation because our mm-hmm. generational characteristics have us kind of leaning into a work-life balance and blend. A knowledgeable and conservative approach to financial planning, working smarter, not harder through use of technologies and efficiencies.
Yes.
So naturally, I would think that I'd lean a little bit more into exit planning, but I don't know. So from somebody that works with owners every day, do you think these are also generationally driven, given nearly 40% of this audience is between the ages of 42 and 56.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
That's probably why the numbers are so good.
Because maybe,
you had some younger owners that actually answered those questions and generationally they are absolutely different.
So when you're working mm-hmm. with the person that's 45, 50, yeah. maybe even 35,
yeah.
you can see the difference.
Open to outside perspective and advice.
Okay.
Don't think that they always have all the answers.
Okay.
Right. Nothing wrong with the boomers. I love them.
Yeah, sure, you
know?
Of course.
But they tend to be DIYers. and you know yeah. why? Because a lot of them have been through a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. When you look back on the typical baby boomer business owner and the major things that had occurred, right, globally yeah. and nationally that they had to weather with their business, it's pretty mind-boggling, right?
Really? They have a great ability to handle crisis, I think.
Yeah. You know, we could go back in history. You got 9/11. You got the 2009 recession. Yep. You've got, you know, Black Monday. I mm-hmm. mean, you know, going back mm-hmm. further, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And all of those things, right? And then the pandemic, which, you know, kind of
shook everybody.
A lot of people are like, I think I'm done. Right.
Well, yeah, it's like I might be able to navigate crisis as a baby boomer, but like I don't know if I need another one at age 65, right. 70,
yeah.
75.
But the younger generation is seeing that it doesn't have to be something that they make a decision to do in their sunset years.
Yeah, right? That's fair.
And
yeah.
And so they're looking at, okay, what are the best practices? I want to make sure that I have options. Mm-hmm. And I know that I don't have all the answers and I need other people to help me with that.
Exactly right.
Yeah. So it's super fun to work with Gen Xers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but super favorable results, right? There's certainly some work that still needs to be done for those of you, for those owners that answered in the traditional way, hey, I'm not really ready at all. I haven't really thought about this.
Right.
But also an opportunity and a challenge to continue the momentum, right? Because these owners
absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely. We're not done.
Right. These owners here are still indicating not a 2-year window, they're saying 3 to 5. So there's still 3 to 5 away.
Yeah.
And
that's
we
a typical
don't.
Typical answer though, you know?
Well, typically, yes, it is. But I think more so than ever. Yeah. Just given the age ranges, it makes sense. So the average baby boomer is 67 years old.
Yeah.
And an E&Y study came out last year that looked at family business owners. And they noted that that they started thinking about transition to the next generation, at least at age 63. Mm. So if you look at the baby boomers, they're 57 to 75, give or take, or 58 to 75, give or take. Naturally, in the next 5 years, they'll all be over 50 and they'll all be close to that average age and that 63-year-old age where they're saying, hey, maybe it's time to think about doing something different. Mm-hmm. And then for the younger folks, to your point, they're like the boomerang owners, right? They're going to sell a business to go then get into another business and build that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so naturally, if that generation is youngest 42, in the next 5 years, they'll be approaching 50, probably starting to think a little bit earlier on than a baby boomer would do. At 50, maybe it's something there's something I could do next, or could I keep this business, decentralize myself enough out of it so I can go do something else as well? But nonetheless, I do think it's the stereotypical 3 to 5 year answer.
Yeah.
But well, I think the data shows that it's a little bit more believable now just given their age.
Right. Well, and because of the way they answered tells all of us that awareness, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've stepped up awareness everywhere. So we can't take all the credit because of our surveys and owners forums in Minnesota. The media certainly helps because you're hearing about it more in the media. You're 100%. Hearing about it from, you know, large scale professional service firms are focusing on it and emphasizing it because they're looking at their database of owners and realizing people aren't taking action.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, especially for the older owners, they are probably more aware that exit planning is a thing and that it's important, but it doesn't mean that they're necessarily, they haven't started the preparation process. Yeah, a lot of them haven't.
So I want to dig into that. It's a good segue. I want to dig into this evolution of exit planning next. So stick with us and we'll be back just after a quick break.
For business owners, by a business owner, Walking to Destiny is your essential resource for understanding what makes your business highly profitable and significant. It becomes a business owner's handbook to know how to rapidly grow value and ultimately unlock the personal wealth trapped in business. Exit Planning Institute CEO Christopher Snyder demonstrates how strategic exit planning will help you achieve improvements today while positioning you to build wealth for generations. Secure your success along other value creators. Discover, prepare, and decide what your walk to destiny will ultimately be. If executed correctly, these strategies can grow a business owner's wealth by 10 times. Walking to Destiny, the second edition, the 11 actions an owner must take to rapidly grow value and unlock wealth. Get your copy today at www.walkingtodestiny.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Exit Is Now podcast. So as we wind down today's episode, when I have folks like Julie in the studio who are obviously super impactful to our space, have been here a while, has watched this thing evolve. It's been this loose theme that we've had at EPI this year ever since launching the summit where my dad talked about the evolution of exit planning. So the question in conclusion is, where do you see us going? What's the next 5 to 10 years of exit planning look like to you? What's the evolution of it? Where are we heading next?
Well, I like to look at exit planning as a form of transition. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, until I'm not working anymore, I'll always be doing transition planning.
Okay.
There's so much to transition planning. Exit is one form of transition, right?
Sure.
There's buying a partner, taking on a partner, selling part of your business to private equity, selling to family members, you know, selling to a partial ESOP, things like that, all those partial different transitions, right? And in the evolution of a business, there are going to be different transition points. And so if exit is part of that, I see that we'll have work to do forever.
I mean, I would agree, right?
Yeah. But more technology, more automation, being able to streamline the service, you know, making sure that we have really good educational content out there so that we can keep people warmed up, right? For the next gen.
Yeah.
And so I just think it's more of the same, only more.
More is more, yeah.
Yeah. Face to face is still important though, right, Scott?
I mean, totally agree.
When we're in the relationship business, we can't automate everything and we can't do everything virtually. But a combination of those that makes sense, I think.
It'll be interesting to see, for me in the 10 years, right, the baby boomer generation actually start to really, we've already seen a little bit of a wave, right? We've gone from 60% of privately held companies in the United States owned by owners down to 51%, owned by baby boomer owners down to 51%. So we've seen that transition, but it'll be interesting over the next 10 years because the youngest baby boomer then in 10 years is like 68. The oldest is like 85. So how we're working in this next generation, you just got thinking about it, given you've talked about like use of technology, but the balance of relationship building and technology, I think will be critical. It's a good point.
For sure. And I think making connections too, if there's a way that we could do that between some of these smaller boomer owned businesses that maybe wouldn't be able to sell conventionally, and connecting them with opportunities for roll-ups and and bolt-ons, things like that, where instead of having a liquidation sale, they actually might be able to
built-in have successors. And
I don't know if there's a service out there that makes those kinds of connections. I don't think so. I think it's happenstance right now. But I think there's going to be more opportunity for, you know, businesses that want to acquire. They're going to have the pick of the litter.
That is true.
With those smaller companies. Because the smaller ones really aren't doing a whole lot.
No. No, I think a lot of them, they're
lifestyle businesses.
They're lifestyle businesses.
Right.
But could be value creator companies very easily.
They could.
If they just change that mentality.
Exactly.
Well, Julie, I think we've come to a conclusion. So I appreciate you flying all the way in from Minneapolis, taking some time out to hang out with us here at EPI and on the show. So for our listeners, our next show is October 11th. So make sure you subscribe, listen, and leave a review on all of your podcast platforms. Julie, thanks for hanging out with us. I really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Good. Thanks. Mm-hmm. We'll have to talk about off air, giving me your critiques of how I did as a fellow podcaster.
I thought you did amazing.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you soon.